This edition of Meet the Writers was first broadcast on the 13th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. It's a special romance edition of the show with a couple of guests this week. A little later on in the programme, I'll be speaking to Catherine Shears. She's produced a book all about the secrets of sewing lingerie and tells us how she travelled to China but ended up marrying the boy next door. And my second guest today is an Austrian journalist, author and former politician. He's founded a newspaper and he was a member of the European Parliament. He's the author of several internationally best-selling books based on interviews and was a foreign correspondent for publications including Stern magazine and the Süddeutsche Zeitung. He currently lives in Chicago. I'm very pleased to welcome Peter Sikorski. His books include Strangers in Their Own Land, Young Jews in Germany and Austria Today, about German and Austrian children of Holocaust survivors, and Born Guilty, Children of Nazi Families, which was adapted into theatrical works in over 15 languages. Other acclaimed books include Abraham's Children, Israel's Young Generation, and a book of interviews with 21st century German neo-Nazis entitled Incurably German. Verklempt is his first collection of short stories, and it looks at love in a post-Holocaust world. Peter, thank you very much for coming on to talk to me. I want to go right back because you're Austrian and so were your parents, but they escaped to London on the eve of the war, and your father, in fact, served in the British Army.
My mother came from Prague in 1938 and my father from Vienna. They actually met here in the UK in Falmouth, where my mother finished high school. And my father wanted to join the army and to come back to Vienna. And at that time, he was also very young. His idea was always to liberate his own country. And he joined the army, which was interesting at that time that the British Army was very careful with refugees coming from Germany and Austria. Mm. So they actually sent him to India and not back to the front against Germany.
And then you moved to China after the war.
Well, my father was a journalist and he was one of the first Austrians allowed to work in China very, very early, 1959. So I lived from 59 to 62 as a child in China. We were very few foreigners in China. It was a very interesting life. It was historically, you know, the breakup with the Soviet Union, China was a very poor country at that time. And the only school that accepted foreigners at that time was an East German communist school. So I got a good training in basic communism at that time.
you went back to Vienna and you studied pharmacy. Now, that's not the most obvious start for a writer.
No. Well, there is an Austrian tradition in science and writing, like Schnitzler, very famous, who was a medical doctor, and others. So, yeah, I was very interested in the more logical, you know, like science, chemistry. I finished actually then in chemistry. And worked a few years in the pharmaceutical industry, but immediately started writing at the same time.
And your start in journalism, how did that happen?
My first two books were books about the pharmaceutical industry. And this is how I got into writing. This is how I got publishers. And then after these first more practical books about my experience in the pharmaceutical industry, I switched to interview books, with the first one about the Young Jews or the generation after the war, and the second one about the children from Nazi families.
And I'd like to have a look at those books in a little bit more detail. So Born Guilty, Children of Nazi Families. You were the first writer, in fact, to conduct interviews with the children and grandchildren of prominent Nazis.
Yes, it was. I was actually surprised at that time that nobody was really interested in the story of the perpetrators. There were lots of books about the Holocaust survivors, but nobody ever wrote any books about the other side. And for me, it was just almost a normal growing up with these people. You know, I grew up after the war in Vienna, and lots of my friends, the other boys and girls I went to school with, had histories that were typically born after the war, but with parents who experienced the Nazi time. So I was almost more interested in this part of history than the other one.
What did you take away? What was your greatest insight into the psyche of those children?
Well, this book has an interesting history. In the beginning, I thought I'd just talk to people who were born after the war and talk about an historic period that they didn't experience themselves, but through their parents. You have to imagine that suddenly in 1945, especially in Austria and Germany, everything that was good before became evil. So you go to school, you learn about the Nazi time, you learn about the Holocaust, but it's not just a part of history, it's a part of family history. So history becomes the history of your father, your grandfather, your uncle, your parents of your friends. And that's a difficult situation to deal with. It's difficult enough to get over an historical period that changes totally. Mm. But you have to more or less go through your puberty, your revolt time against your parents, not only because they are your parents, but also they represent something that is evil, what you learn in school or see in movies.
Mm. Do you think you can have inherited guilt?
Some of them feel responsible. The book is a mixture of people who feel terribly responsible up to hating their parents or finding material that they never knew of. One of the issues that happened in almost every interview, that they didn't know anything about the parents. They were told, you know, your father was a soldier, finished. And then sometimes when the father died, they went through the documents and it was a shock for them to find out. And some of them feel guilty, some of them don't feel guilty. You see every possibility.
Another book that you've written is Strangers in Their Own Land, and this is about young Jews in Germany and Austria today. These are people who've chosen to stay in countries where they were persecuted. Did you get a sense from them why that was?
Well, actually, their parents came back, so they were almost forced to grow up in a country that was decided by their parents to come back. Many of them just still saw Germany and Austria as their home country. And they were very hopeful that everything will change after 45. Once they grew up and they studied, many of them left. So you have almost a movement a generation later. Even I'm the best case. You know, my parents chose to come back in 1946. But not only I, also my two brothers left Austria.
Why? Where's home?
Nowhere. Wherever you live then, you give up home. You're very attached to Austria. You know, I go back two or three times a year and I like it, but I don't want to live there anymore. Okay. It's just too much history.
Do you think that there's still a lot of anti-Semitism there?
Well, Austria has a very strange history with anti-Semitism. I think it's the way it is described, also, by the way, very often in British media, I think is too negative. My father always made the cynical joke, the difference between Austria and Germany is the difference between anti-Semitism and the Holocaust. Hmm. There's a very casual way of being anti-Semitic in Austria, but it's not as aggressive and brutal as it maybe happens in other countries or it happened in Germany.
So you've got all these books that, based on interviews that you were doing alongside all of those themes, but you were also founded a very liberal newspaper. Tell me about that.
When I lived in New York in the 80s, I met an Austrian journalist who wanted to start a new newspaper, and it's called The Standard. And he went back in 89 or 88, and he asked me to join him. And we started the newspaper more or less together. And yeah, it still exists. It's still surviving. Yeah, it's a more liberal left-wing newspaper.
Which makes your subsequent political career all the more odd.
Well, I was never left. I was never left or liberal. Maybe because I never got out of my childhood because my father was a communist. So instead of revolting in 68 and becoming left, I became more and more right-wing. Not really right-wing. Well, if you look at the Austrian history again, you have a right-wing party today, which is an extreme right-wing party. But in the 90s, there was a movement within the party to become more a center conservative party.
So tell us about which party, who and why, and what the political landscape was at the time.
At the time, the Freedom Party was the only opposition party. You always had a coalition between the conservatives and the socialists, and they controlled the country for like 30 years. And the only opposition party was the more conservative or right-wing Freedom Party. And of course, the very famous politician at that time, Jörg Haider, then stepped down and invited another woman, Susanne Ries, to take over the party and move it more to the center. And she invited journalists, people from other, you know, non-politicians to join the party and work in the parliament, which worked very well, and they even joined the government. It became a coalition government for the first time in the history of the party, together with a conservative. But in 2002, this all started in 99. In 2002, the extreme right-wing part within the party took over again, kicked us out. So we tried, it worked for a while, but we failed.
Mm. But you stayed on within the European Parliament as an independent.
Yeah, because I was elected and didn't want to, you know, I also got paid every month and they said I should step down. And I said, you know, I'm not elected by a party. I'm elected in a general election. And I stayed from 2002 to 2004 till the end of my term.
And do you think that the European Parliament now is in a position to really make meaningful policy change, particularly where we look at the current migrant crisis?
Well, I don't think the European Parliament has the power that is usually reported or as it is described. If you look at the hierarchy of the European institutions, at the end of the day, it's the Commission, it's the local governments that meet there. European Parliament has almost no power at all, can have an opinion, and they cannot solve any problem. For me, it was more a theater. You know, you sit there and you see people from all over Europe and they discuss something and presentations. It might be a cynical description, but for me, it was just, you know, sitting in a movie and watching what was going on in Europe.
Now, of course, a lot of your books have been made into theatrical works. That's quite an odd process, isn't it? Seeing what you've written now come alive in a different dimension.
Well, it was interesting that the interview books, which I choose to write, they are monologues, worked very well on stage. It was also produced here in the UK. Born Guilty was also in the Edinburgh Festival and in London. And these people come out on stage and just tell a story. And it was never written as a play, but it worked very well as a play.
Mm. Let's now go on to your most recent book. Yeah. Now, it's called Verklempt. What does that mean?
Well, verklempt is coming from a German word for klempt, but it's also a Yiddish word. It's very difficult to translate. It's a combination of feeling uncomfortable, tight, you know, nervous. You're just uneasy with a situation.
And in terms of translating it, you write in German yourself and then it's translated by someone else?
Yes, yeah. It was first published in German and then translated into English.
So let's talk about what's in it, because it's a collection of short stories. And for you, this is a departure because it's not based on interviews. But is it based on real events?
Yes, most of the stories, some were... you know, I got the idea sometimes even in just sitting in a coffee shop and listening to people sitting, arguing next to me on another table, or reading a story somewhere in the newspaper. It's a mixture of facts and fiction.
Now, it's been described as a book about love in a post-Holocaust world. How would you describe it?
First of all, it's more about the assimilated liberal part of the Jewish community, so it's not really about the Orthodox, who just always stay among each other. You're influenced by the history of your parents, you're influenced by being very lonely in a way that you don't grow up in Israel or in a big Jewish community, so you're always confronted in relationship with people who have a completely different story. You try to be, you know, see the Jewishness as a home, but at the same time you live in a non-Jewish world. It's all this mixture of trying to find a home and an identity within the Jewish world, but at the same time with, you know, in the country where you live, in the society where you live.
How autobiographical is it?
Well, there's actually two stories that are very autobiographic. The others, I wouldn't say they're about myself, but there's a lot in the book about relatives, brother, relationships I had. There's a lot in the book that happened in a way either with me or around me.
And how has writing this book impacted on your life, the fact that it is quite true to your own life? How have people around you reacted to it?
Well, one story is about my best friend. I only have one friend. And he didn't talk to me for 6 months after the story. So, you know, the problem with a writer, if they use people who recognize themselves, you're just not very careful as a writer. You can't be careful. It's not even being honest, but just without any respect or with any carefulness, you have to just put anything on paper that goes through your mind. Yeah.
So what will you put next on paper? What's Peter Sikorski's next big work?
I'm working on a kind of biography without really having the facts detailed. It's a collection of 4 or 5 chapters. I was married several times. I don't know if this is too personal, but anyway. So I married 4 times, and the title of the book is 4 Wives and a Mother.
Uh-huh.
And it's a collection of longer short stories that is written in a way that the 5 women talk about me. So I'm turning it around so I don't talk about my life. This will definitely will create a problem with the ex-wives. but it's a it's almost finished. It will be published next year.
So finally, we're on the eve of Valentine's Day, and Verklempt, your new book, has love as a theme running through it, and your book that you have yet to finish also. Clearly, even though your relationship with your ex-wives may not be loving now, but must have some element of love in it. Do you have any kind of romantic insight that you can share with us?
You're touching a very difficult subject. I'm not a very romantic person. I think all my partner now, or my wife now, and the ex-wife, you know, they had to suffer because I never knew what to do on Valentine's Day. I was always too late of booking a restaurant or finding anything. I see it more as a kind of best friend and commitment, being available, you know, helping whenever your partner, your children, or your friend need you. It's more a kind of loyalty, especially today, because it's just an egoistic world. People are so desperate to survive, so desperate to be successful, and fighting against each other. So you need one or two people who would do anything for you. It doesn't matter when, where, at any cost. You know, the Greek had 4 words for love, different love. We use it for anything. I saw a sign in the U.S., cars love shell. So maybe it's time to, as special as a writer, to find a new word to express the kind of feelings you have for another person.
What might that word be?
I have no idea. I'm still looking. I haven't found one.
Peter Sikorski, author of Verklempt, amongst many other works. Thank you very much for coming on.
Well, thank you.
Now, talking about romance, it's time to slip into something more comfortable. Catherine Shears is a lover of silk and lace. She's written a book about lingerie, more specifically, how to make it. I started by asking her how one becomes an underwear designer.
I'd always loved fabrics and textiles. I'd sewn since I was very young. So I started my university education at Chelsea College of Art, studying textile design. And while I loved the fabrics, you know, we were dyeing, you know, yarns at the very basic sort of level to weave and to knit. I loved that process, but it always felt unfinished. I wanted to see these fabrics I was printing and weaving put into a context. And I was very lucky in the second year of university, I was offered a chance to study abroad at FIT, Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. Flicking through the brochure, there was a class called Foundation Design. It was the design and the construction of what, you know, the Americans term intimate apparel, lingerie design. I took it and I fell in love with it. It just made sense. It was the first time I think I'd really explored seeing very, very small, intricate 2D pattern pieces and then trying to work in my mind how that becomes a 3D form, something that has shape and structure. And I loved it. I really, really loved it. So much so that actually when I came back to the UK, I did, long story short, I'd won some scholarship money from design competition out there. I used it to do short courses at the only university at that time in the world that actually had a degree specialising in lingerie design, which was De Montfort in Leicester. And again, these courses, they just bred that love of lingerie and this sort of designing within very tight boundaries. So much so that I actually asked whether it'd be possible to transfer my degree. And 2 weeks before my final year, I did that to the contour design degree at De Montfort, which I studied in 1 year then and completed and got a first. And it was a hard year.
You did 2 years in one, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes, yes. But I think if you've really got a passion for something, especially probably when you're young, you don't have any other responsibilities. You put whatever you can into it. And so it's long days and nights, but I loved it. It was fantastic.
Tell me about your jobs, what you've, the big companies you've worked for and the really interesting places you've lived with that.
Well, I think when things really started to get interesting for me was with a job offer, which involved moving to Sri Lanka. It was actually working for a lingerie elastics manufacturer, doing their trend and their sample garments, and as well as designing the elastics. And I thought the sound of getting to go and live in a country which was so far removed from my culture that I'd never visited was intriguing. So I up sticks and moved to Sri Lanka. I think in terms of being pivotal to making me assess what my role was as a lingerie designer, what am I contributing to the world, and actually what does it mean to be part of mass manufacture, really came when I took a job that was initially based in China in Guangdong province. And that was designing for a supplier to Victoria's Secret. And as they are undoubtedly the sort of, you know, Victoria's Secret sort of have the global market share, you know, in lingerie, the volume of product that's sort of manufactured is astounding. So this is really the extreme of mass manufacture in the lingerie world. And I was actually based in the factory in China, and I lived there as well.
In an industrial town?
Yes, very much so. I think that was one of the things that I found most surreal to actually, you know, have as your living environment. I mean, a culture which I know, obviously, Cultural Revolution, you know, aside, it's so steeped in culture. I expected to be immersed in something which felt ancient. And actually, I was living in an environment which had been created in order to, you know, support the migrant, internal migrant workers. And as such, it was very, very rare to see anyone elderly, for example, because anyone who wasn't of a working age would not move there. And the attitude there was a very, very, very sort of work-focused and work-dominated, to earn as much money as possible, to work as many hours as possible, to send money back home. And so it was a bit of a desert in terms of, you know, no art galleries, no theatres. I mean, there might well have been cinemas in Chinese, but I suddenly was without a lot of what I'd rely on to sort of dip into for inspiration and just for context of what was happening in the world. But I think, you know, in our modern digital age, one of the things that was most bizarre was living within the Chinese firewall and suddenly finding that, you know, the social media, which I was used to, being able to have a freedom of search on Google and anything come up, was that was it. That was no longer part of my life. And it was the first taste of actually what it might be like for one of my, you know, contemporary female Chinese workers living in this environment and only seeing what was allowed to be seen.
So ultimately, living in this industrial town in China wasn't sustainable, really, for you?
I think working in China, it really galvanized what I loved and didn't love about design and the design world. And one of the things that, as I sat there in my Chinese sort of, you know, desk, I realized that I missed terribly was the more hands-on making element of design. I began to feel very detached from what I was creating. And so various things in my personal life had been calling me back home. I'd met a man who was later to become my husband.
Do you know what? I think you've got to tell us how you met, because it's so romantic.
Oh, well, yeah. When I was growing up in Wales, I lived very near a beautiful mountain called Skerrid Hill. And as far as I was concerned, it was my mountain. Every Sunday, I'd climb up it, and I'd always go up on my own. That was my treat. When I was living in China, I was unusually homesick. I'd travelled for a lot of years, but I missed Wales one night. And I was online. I'd Googled, first of all, paintings and then poetry about my hill, the Skerrid. And these beautiful poems came up. I looked at the poet's name, and I thought, hang on, Owen Shears. I went to school with someone called Owen Shears. That can't be the same boy. And I do tease him that his author photo was ancient. And so I realised, yes, he was the same boy that I'd gone to school with. And it turns out that he'd considered this mountain his as well. In fact, he'd named his second poetry collection Skerrid Hill after it. And I got in touch. We exchanged messages and found that we live unusually parallel lives. And so after a period of correspondence, we were both travelling back to Wales for Christmas, me from China, him from London. And we agreed to meet. He'd suggested a pub very sensibly. And I said, no, I've got a few days back in Wales. I want to be, you know, in my hills. So we agreed to meet on the Skirrid in the landslide dip. So I get there, I'm bringing the tea. He says he'll light the fire and we arrange to meet. It takes me about 45 minutes to walk around the mountain. And I finally get this text saying, are you still coming? I'm almost at the landslide. So I say, yes, yes, where are you? At this point, it's getting very dark. It's sort of about 5 in the evening at Christmas. And a message comes back going, I'm by the fire. You know, I'm looking around. There's no sign of fire. And there's a pause. And I suddenly get another message going, oh, my goodness, I think you've gone to the wrong landslide dip. Turn around, come back the way you came. I'll try and find you. And depending on which side of the mountain you grew up, we grew up on different sides. There's either a very small landslide dip, which is sensibly 15 minutes from the car park, or there's a very big landslide dip about an hour on the other end of the mountain. Of course, we were, you know, going to our own sense of what that place was. So we walked back. At this point, it was pitch black. And the first time we saw each other, we were two torchlights coming towards each other in the dark. So, yeah, great relief that we didn't have to involve mountain rescue or anything like that. But yes.
Now you have a baby.
And now we're married. We live in those mountains, not that one specifically, but nearby. And we have a young daughter. Yes. Yeah.
And your life has changed because now you're a maker. You have a homemade life, as you call it. So you have a wonderful website that goes along with it, a blog, and then this fantastic book. Yeah. So let's talk about it. It's called The Secrets of Sewing Lingerie. Make your own divine knickers, bras and camisoles. And you've done it together with Laura Stanford.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me about it.
Well, when I was coming back from China, I was sort of very aware that there was this resurgence of interest in home sewing and making, and I think possibly, you know, sort of shift away from mass manufactured, people wanting to have products which had more story. And about 5 years previously, I'd had an idea to write a book which showed people how to sew their own lingerie. I loved the idea of it, but it didn't feel the right time. So when I came back to the UK, I asked Laura, who was a good friend from university, whether she'd be interested in, you know, doing the book with me. She was. She'd reached a similar point where she wanted to be more sort of involved with the product and with her customer. And we got together and developed the concept together from there. And it was a joy. It was an absolute joy. It was such a contrast to the world of mass design. So each piece was considered for its own beauty. But we wanted it to be accessible to everybody who could pick up a needle and thread, who could sew a straight line on a sewing machine. That we wanted to sort of say, if you can do that, then we'll show you how to make these beautiful things. We didn't want it to be exclusive. We did a lot of research and used reference points with sort of vintage pieces of lingerie as to how people were sewing it, looking at techniques which, you know, now have sort of been passed over for using more specialist machinery like overlockers. And we sort of brought those back. We wanted to put them all together and into one book again. And I hope we've managed to make something that's beautiful, but also practical. I think we wanted it to be functional as well, not just to be a pretty coffee table book.
It's a tremendous success. It's absolutely beautiful. These from little whispers of silk to bits of sort of clean cotton. It's just really, yeah, really lovely. Catherine Shears, just before we go, will you show me your bra?
I'll show you my strap. I think it's peachy with a sort of a gold ring and slide and a little bit wide for a 1950s instance.
Fantastic. The Secrets of Sewing Lingerie is by Catherine Shears and Laura Stanford. It's out now. It will help you make your own divine knickers, bras and camisoles. Happy Valentine's Day. And that brings us to the end of the show. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Join us again to listen live at the same time next week or subscribe to the SoundCloud channel for free and never miss an episode. Thanks to my guests, to Claire Urban for production and Hanjin Wong for research, and of course to you for listening. I'm Georgina Godwin. Goodbye.